If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hey, Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Stuart Copeland giving you the story behind the song on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to the story behind the song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. Well, dear listeners, we've reached the end of season 4 of the story behind the song. I've been doing this for 4 years now and have had the great privilege of interviewing over 50 iconic and legendary artists all along the way. And today's season 4 finale episode is no different. I revisit my interview with Stuart Copeland, drummer of The Police, a band that sold over 75 million albums, but shockingly called it quits in 1984 after only 5 albums and when their star was still on the rise. And of course, we talk about Roxanne, The Police's iconic breakout song. Roxanne, you don't need to put on the red light. Who doesn't know those immortal words and my singing of them? No one, but Roxanne almost didn't make any sound at all when it was first released. It only broke out when The Police's record label released it a second time 1 year later. My interview with the hyperkinetic and endlessly entertaining Copeland is full of surprises. Why does the beginning of Roxanne feature that piano mistake, followed by Sting's laughter? How did Copeland come to the unpleasant conclusion, as he calls it, that Sting is a fucking genius? Will the band ever get back together to play their hits? Just listen, and all of your questions will be answered in this special episode, which is still one of my personal favorites. So let's take another dive deep into the story behind The Police's enduring classic, Roxanne. So Stuart formed the band in 1977. The band sold over 75 million albums. Their debut album, Outlandis D'Amour, came out 45 years ago. So it's celebrating a big anniversary this year. Of course, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2023. You are a solo artist, Clark Kent. You have another band, Gizmodrome, and you just won a recent Grammy Award for that band. I think it was that band.
Yeah, two Grammys in 2 years. Last year, we got the Grammy for a New Age album. And this year, the same record got a Grammy for Best Immersive Mix.
So how does that happen that it's 2 years?
Well, the first album came out, won its award, and then we did another version of the album, which was an immersive mix.
Yeah.
And then cool. put that up the following year and got ourselves another plaque.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Really? Well, I discovered an incredible talent, this guy Ricky Cage over there in Bangalore, India.
Yeah.
Oh, man, my new musical love of my life. The guy is so incredibly talented over there, and he assembles these incredible musicians, and which resulted in that album.
Well, very good. And also film scoring. You've scored multiple films, Golden Globe nomination, operas, books, and a new book's going to be coming out. Videos, of course, soundtrack to the BlackBerry.
That's a very obscure brag, by the way. Yeah. If you'll indulge me for just a second. For a film composer, hired again, the one-upmanship is how much were you paid per note? And whoever has the highest per note payment is top dog. And for that one, it's five notes. BlackBerry paid me for their branding, their logo.
Yeah.
Audio logo. Ba-dum-bum-bum-bum. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's five notes. And divide the fee. And they pay cash money. They don't pay royalty. They pay cash money buyout. So they own it. They can do anything they want with it. They don't got to pay you no royalties. Cash money. So that cash money divided by five notes did, in fact, put one of my kids through private school for a year for each note. How about that? That's a brag.
I need that kind of work. That's great work. I want to get a little background, Stuart, of you and just how you became a drummer in the first place. But you do much more than just drum. Like I said, you have Clark Kent, you sing, you play multiple instruments. But how did you begin to focus on drumming as a young lad?
Well, I think a buddy of mine had a brochure from Slingerland Drum Company with all the, you know, each page was a picture, and the first page is a picture of a drum set. Wow, cool, look at that. And the next page is a slightly bigger drum set with like two tom-toms. Whoa! And then the center fold-out was like a double bass drum kit with four tom-toms. And oh my God, for a 12-year-old, that was just like, you know, the pages got stuck together, of course, you know. But you know, but the main thing was that I got me, you know, and I was banging on stuff. And my father, who was a musician himself, but my older siblings, none of them could play an instrument. They didn't have the bug, the gene. And so when I started banging stuff, he immediately, first of all, he rented me a drum set just to see what would happen. Yeah. And I was kind of a late developer. All my friends were shaving and bulking up, and I was still just a little pipsqueak. But as soon as I hit those drums, I became an 800-pound silverback gorilla swinging through the trees, motherfucker.
I love it.
Even though I was 12 and a still skinny little kid, I could bang in those drums and suddenly be 10 times bigger.
God, that's awesome.
Instant adult masculinity. That's what drew me to the drums. Then the night I was playing at the American Embassy Beach Club in Beirut, Lebanon, and there we were playing James Brown, and there right in front of me was Janet McRoberts, who was like 15. Now, 15-year-old to a girl, to a 12-year-old boy, that is just heaven revealed. And there she was, her body being moved to my rhythm. I'm making her move her hips like that. That there deepened the connection with music. And by the way, as an adult, looking at what music does, which is what no other art form does, music is the only art form that will physically usurp motor control of your body. You know, literature doesn't do that, movies, poetry, nothing does that. But music will actually take your hips and cause them to move in a suggestive fashion.
Amen to that. I love all that. By the way, for those of you who are listening to the podcast and not watching, Stuart is endlessly moving, walking around while I sit here sedentary. So I also applaud that.
I'm walking around the Sacred Grove. Here it is, folks, the Sacred Grove.
Wow.
Where my fancy friends come to play.
How many drum sets do you have in there?
Well, just one at the moment. But I, you know, Neil Peart came over and Danny Carey both, so I'd have two drum sets. But also got the percussion rig back there.
Yeah.
And I've got the largest collection of the cheapest instruments money can buy.
Well, they certainly work for you, so that's great.
Yeah, I mean, I got all the guitars, I got trombone, I got clarinet, I got timpani, and it's all wired for sound. The whole studio is plugged in and ready to go, so that when my chuckle buddies come over, we just jam, and it's all in record.
That's awesome. You need to put out an album. Or just put some of that music out there. Maybe you are already.
It is out there.
Some of the jam sessions.
Oh, yeah. The jam sessions are on YouTube. Look for, you know, Neil Peart at the Sacred Grove, or Taylor Hawkins at the Sacred Grove, or Snoop Dogg or Ben Harper or Stanley Clarke or, you know, my friends can. And by the way, I've got movie cameras around as well that I just turn them on. They got 6 hours of memory. I just flip them on and the guys forget about them until next day. I come in all hungover and I cut these tracks to videos, which are up on YouTube. Check them out. Free for all the people to enjoy.
See, that's
no
wonderful.
Commercial agenda or anything. They're just up there.
Stuart, you have a pretty good life, don't you?
I love it.
Yeah, that's good. That's great.
I'm very lucky and very grateful.
Well, and we're very grateful as fans. I want to get into your style a little bit. How did you create this very unique style that makes you one of the greatest drummers in the world? And this, like, the as a drummer myself, the syncopation that you have and how you're able to move your limbs in different speeds and all that sort of thing. How did that come to be?
Well, the limbs part is, I was studied by a UCLA study group who were studying creativity, and they put me in an MRI just to see what's going on in my brain when I think up a tune and everything. And one of the things they found is the connection between my two lobes, the somethingus maximus, connects the two lobes, is very thin in my case. I got amygdala the size of watermelons, but the connecting thing, and what that means is the two lobes of my brain are less connected than most people. And I don't know if that's because when I was 16, I was learning separation of the different limbs, or whether it's an effect of what I did, or whether I was born that way, which made it easier for me to do this. Who knows? But that's that limb independence. But the cultural stuff, where did that come from? That my secret sauce is that it's Arabic. I grew up, my formative years musically were in Beirut, Lebanon, in the middle of the Middle East, surrounded by Arabian culture. And Arabic music happens to have a rhythmic foundation, which is an emphasis on the third beat in the bar, and you subtract the one. Two, three, four, nothing. Two, three, four, two, three, four, two. And so that absence of one, emphasis on three, shares a foundational structure with reggae, which also emphasizes the third beat of the bar and hides the one. And so when we discovered reggae and started kind of introducing that attitude into our music, I already had it in my DNA. And I could do it wrongly, not correct reggae, but kind of reggae adjacent, which was actually the influence of Arabic culture.
You know, it's first of all, that's fascinating. So much of the Police's song sound is, unlike many bands where the percussionist, the drummer, is supporting the song and I'm not going to say a side piece to it, but not a leading actor in it. Whereas with your drumming, it is such an essential part of the overall sound of the Police, and it sets the tone, really. And that's
as he was saying all that, I was thinking about how Stingo would be responding. He would be nodding his head vigorously. Yes, that's right. There was all kinds of banging and stuff going on there that had nothing to do with a song I wrote.
Well, but
nowadays we both appreciate what that clash produced.
Yeah, yeah, it's magic. One of the things you've said, and before we get into the stories, that you play with impunity. That's the word. You play with impunity. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an excuse. I play with lack of discipline. It just seems to work better. I'm a terrible session musician. I had to do it back in the day to earn my living, but I'm not really good at remembering the arrangement the way you're supposed to. And they'd say, that second chorus, go dubba da bunga da unga da hunk. And I'd get to that part and I'd think of something else to play. And I'd play, you know, differently every time. So I'm kind of a pain in that regard. I play just instinctively. And I dignify it by calling it impunity. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's just, I play instinctively. I'm not thinking, you know, when I'm composing, I think a lot.
Yeah.
And when I'm creating a piece of music in my head or putting it on the page, that's a completely different animal to the guy banging stuff. You know, when I'm sitting on the drums banging things, I'm not thinking at all. I'm just instinctively doing what comes up. And I guess we can call it impunity. That makes it sound really cool.
And it does sound cool. And you're left-handed, is that right?
Yes.
But yet I read that I didn't even know there was a right, I guess there's a right-handed drum kit, because usually you have the, well, I don't even recall when.
Well,
I
on drums, you don't, left-handed people like Ringo, or guitar even, musical instruments require both hands to be very clever. And left-handedness or right-handedness doesn't really make a difference, because on the drum set, both hands are working. And to try and rearrange a drum set to make it a left-handed drum set means you're never, ever going to get to sit in with a band, because it's just too disruptive to move you got to move everything, you know.
Yeah.
Guitar, at least you can just turn it upside down like Jimi Hendrix did and play any old guitar.
Yeah.
You don't have to restring it or anything. But left hand, it makes you play differently. Certainly Ringo Starr played differently. Just his came up, he leading with the left hand instead of the right hand just creates different drum. But both hands are working on any instrument.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get back to you and forming the band back in 1977. I think that's when you formed. And you lay out the story of how you met Sting and how you met Andy and came together as the band and created your sound.
Well, it's funny you should ask me about that. It so happens that I've got a book coming out.
There you go. See, teed
let's
up.
Sell some teed books. Up. Teed up. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I was playing in a prog rock band called Curved Air, touring up in Northern England. And a local journalist in Newcastle said, hey, you got to check out our hot local band. And they were called Last Exit. And we went to see them, and they were indeed a really great band. But in the band was a bass player who could sing. And I was looking for I wanted a three-piece band. I already had the name, The Police, but I needed a three-piece band where either the guitarist or the bass player needs to also be the singer, you know? And I saw that guy, he could play bass and sing, and he had his own amp. Okay, he's in, that's it, qualified right there. But there was another factor which did play a part, which was a golden ray of celestial light descending from the heavens upon his magnificent brow. This shaft of celestial light indicated that this guy was going to be my meal ticket. And so I got his number and I called him sometime later, just as the punk scene was breaking out and I wanted a band. And I wanted that bass player up in Newcastle, that Lion King guy, you know, let me give him a call. And I called up the journalist.
Yeah.
And asked him for his telephone number. And I was telling him about this cool scene happening in London, this new punk scene. It's really great. You know, it's a whole new thing, tear down the wall. And I didn't notice, because I was talking so fast, that the temperature was dropping. And when it came, so that bass player guy, you know, give me his number. And he said, no. What do you mean, no? I don't want you stealing, you know, this guy from our great Newcastle, you know, band. And punk, are you kidding? I'm not giving you his number. And so I hung up and I'm walking around there thinking, God darn it, gosh darn it. So finally, I came up with a much more convincing argument and, you know, with something along the lines, give me his fucking number.
That's pretty convincing.
Yeah. So I called him back. Only this time he didn't pick up. His girlfriend did. Hello. She turned out she was a Curved Air fan. That was the band I was playing at.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Oh, great. Anything I can do to help? Well, you know that bass player, Sting, they played in last, got his phone number. She's Phil's got it. Let me find his phone. About half a tick. And I can hear her footsteps receding. And then her footsteps coming back up. Okay, here it is. 034-791-283. And I called him up. And pretty soon there's that voice that we're also familiar with now on the line. And I say, first of all, this is a conversation about just you, not your band. Just you. You want to, you know, I got this idea, you know. And he says, keep talking.
Ah, that's funny.
And that voice, keep talking.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how singers sing so beautiful, but have really gruff voices. You know, Bono's like that too. His speaking voice is so different from his singing voice.
Yeah.
Anyhow, a couple of things. First of all, keep talking means, okay, I'm ready to deal without my band. Second thing, keep talking, which is what I had to do for the next 2 years to keep him in the band. And as soon as he got down to London and people got a look at him, people were whispering in his ear every which way. And just to hold on to that guy, I had to keep talking. Yeah, we got a photo session, tomorrow. We got gigs coming. I had to keep talking, keep things moving forward so that I wouldn't lose him.
But what was your pitch for him to leave Last Exit and join you on this mission with the police?
Couple things. First of all, it was in London, which is where he knew he had to get to, the big city. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I was living in a squat at the time, but it was in Mayfair. And Mayfair is like the top, in the British Monopoly, Mayfair is the top purple one. And long story, what I was doing in this two-story penthouse apartment in the middle of Mayfair, for which I was not paying rent, long story, but he comes in, he sees, something going on here. He was impressed by that. But the really weird part is that I played him my tapes that I made of my crap song, my three chord tricks, my fake punk songs that, it had to be punk because that was the only scene that was happening. And I played him these songs that I had, which were just bass lines with yelling, and he did not run away. That's the miracle. And I've still got those tapes. And for this book, this diaries book, I pulled them out and listened to them, and they're pretty dire.
Would you ever have those see the light of day?
Oh, yeah, they will.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, one of these days is going to be an Outlando deluxe edition with those songs on it. And also in my book, in the fancy version, stupidly priced version, as opposed to the regular book priced version, there's a CD with some of these tracks on it. And the amazing thing is, they were pretty basic. And in fact, we stuck together for a couple of years with me doing a lot of talking. But when he plugged in that bass and we got blasting away, we knew that we were in the right company. And it wasn't until, and we didn't have Roxanne, Andy, it wasn't until Andy joined that Sting was able to start writing songs.
But from the very beginning, did you have this reggae-ish kind of feeling? Was that
No, that came later. It was strictly Ramalama punk. And I knew four chords, and I stretched them pretty thin to create our set. But when Andy joined, which he had much more sophistication in his playing, that's when Sting, his ears pricked up, and he started writing songs.
Three, obviously, to make that kind of sound is not a common thing in rock and roll. So why did you think of three as being what you wanted? That was the goal of your band.
Lots of room in the car. One driver, three band members, everybody's comfortable. An extra singer, and that's like three guys got to hunch up in the back seat there. Fuck that.
Very practical.
And Jimi Hendrix did it. Cream did it. Why not?
Yeah.
Even Grand Funk Railroad did it.
Yeah.
Mention ZZ Top. It can be done.
That's true.
You just need to find two real motherfuckers to complete the circle.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get into the story behind Roxanne. But thank you for that musical journey to get up to the point of the first album and the classic, iconic song, Roxanne. So everybody will be right back with Stuart Copeland from the great band The Police and so many more things as we dig in a little bit more deeply. Okay, we are back with Stuart Copeland. So, Stuart, let's talk about Roxanne and going into the studio with Outlandis and why don't you just take us through the journey of that song as you remember it, like from the very first germ of it and how it became, how you then took that song and into the recording studio and the production of it.
Well, we were in Paris, 1970, probably beginning of 78. And we were doing shows with Generation X, which was Billy Idol's band.
Yeah.
All the musicians were all good buddies. We were hanging out in London. But Sting kind of carved off on his own that night. Ended up in the Pigalle, which is the red light district. And he saw these women of the night. And it sort of piqued his interest. And he went home and wrote that song, Roxanne, it was sort of a love song to a prostitute. Then he hit it. It had no place in The Police as we were in those days. Sometime later, months later, He was actually staying with Andy when his house was being repainted, or for some reason he was overnighting at Andy's place. Then he was strumming these chords like a bossa nova. And Andy says, cool. And his ears pricked up and said, we should do that. And he says, no, Stuart will never go for that. You know, it's not punky enough. It's a ballad, for God's sake. Bossa nova, are you kidding? But Andy insisted. So next band rehearsal, Andy says, Stingo, that song, you know, the one about the prostitute, let's work on that. I heard it and thought, well, let's rock it. Let's take it out of bossa nova. Let's do something. Let's make it ours. In fact, let's do the rhythm backwards. Put two where one should be and one where three should be and do it upside down. And in those days, Sting was very malleable because he hadn't been confirmed as a writer of hits. He still felt kind of codependent mm-hmm. with the rest of the band. And just to keep us interested, he would listen to our input and be much more malleable than he became later. So we were able to mess up the rhythm and add the chunky, heavy guitar chords to it and do a noisier chorus to keep it, you know, something fit for a rock band. Even a punk band could get away with it, borderline. And so that became the version of Roxanne that people are familiar with.
So in the studio, who produced the album or that track? Was that, or did you produce it yourselves?
We had an engineer who was kind of like referee. If anyone would be producer, we'd call them, you know, Nigel Gray, but really he was an engineer. He knew where to put the microphones, but he also had a great bedside manner and was a great referee. But we produced it, the three of us, by two against one is a great way to arrive at a band decision very efficiently and quickly. And so we're actually quite effective as producers. In later albums, it was we could have done with, you know, with more umpiring, more refereeing, because it got very difficult. Because now we all knew how to make records. At first, Andy and I knew how to make records, but our principal songwriter had never made a record before. It was easier, but it got a lot harder later. For the first album only, we had been playing the songs live. So when we went into the studio, we could just run them down and that's it. So the recording of the backing track came very quickly because we had been playing it on stage. The vocal has that moment where Sting does his vocal overdub. And in the introduction, he's waiting for the song to begin. And they say, hang on, we're going to run the tape back. And the tape was running, so he sits back on the piano, which is right behind him, and forgetting that the lid was open. So he sits down and plays a butt chord, I think B flat minor. And then he laughs because, oops, that was the, you know, and that's on the record.
Which is so classic because I've always wondered about that. And so that's a real story that he sat down and that was just his laughter when he sat down and made that mistake and you kept it in there.
Yeah, it had a vibe. It had nothing to do with the song. Completely out of keeping with the sentiment of the lyric.
Completely.
But kind of had a vibe.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. When you're done recording the album, how did you feel about that particular track, Roxanne? Did it stand out to you three immediately or...
No, it was still kind of an outlier. And we were recording and my brother Miles came down, who was not yet our manager.
Yeah.
But I used his offices. I used his Rolodex. And he was a huge resource for the band. But he came down just to offer advice. And he used to supply something very valuable called Dumbass. He doesn't know anything about music, but he knows a hit when he hears it. And he is studiously ignorant of chords or anything musical because it's irrelevant.
Amazing.
If folks are going to like it, they're going to like it not because it's, you know, A flat minor. And so he was there to provide some Dumbass, keep us honest. And he listened to all of our songs and said, well, they're all kind of standard. I'm not hearing anything that really, you know, gets me going here. And we got one left, which we were afraid to play for him because it was kind of subdued. He was like me, kind of a, you know, punk messiah at the time. It had to be punk. But we played it to him somewhat reluctantly. And immediately his ears perked up. Now that is a unique sound. I'm going to take that to a record company, see if we can get ourselves a deal. And that's kind of when he became our manager right there. He said, now that I can work with. And he took it to a record company, A&M Records, and the rest is history.
Yeah. I
mean, actually, there's a little bit more. It disappeared without a trace. When A&M put it out, they signed us for like a couple singles, mm-hmm. which they tried, Roxanne, Canceled and Losing You. They both sank without a trace. Because in the case of Roxanne, we went off to Germany to earn some money playing as a backing band for a German artist over there. But that's how we fed ourselves while our single came out. So we were not there to promote the record. Soon after that, I had a record that was just too dumb for Sting to sing called Don't Care. So I recorded, played all the instruments myself, guitar, bass, drums, even sang the damn thing. But in the radio, BBC Radio 1 picked it up, put it on the playlist. So I actually had a hit as Clark Kent with A Secret Identity, because the Police were already written off by the critics as uncool, unhip, and fake. You know, three carpetbaggers, previously long-haired, bell-bottomed, they spotted us as carpetbaggers right away. And so with A Secret Identity as Clark Kent, I actually had a hit. It went on national TV to play the song, but I didn't want to play by myself, so I had Sting and Andy pretend to be my band, all in masks. There we were on Top of the Pops. And that was our first time on national television under the name of Clark Kent. And around about then, I'm thinking, wow, this is cool. I hit on my own. I don't need these guys. Ha ha. Fortunately, Clark Kent disappeared without a trace in the nick of time. And then right after that, Can't Stand Losing You came out for the second time and actually surpassed Clark Kent by about 2 points on the chart. And the rest is history.
But was it because Clark Kent, the three of you were on stage on that program, that's the reason why I Can't Stand Losing You was then released once again? Because
no.
They're
unrelated. First of all, we were all in masks, so nobody who knew was on stage at that time.
What kind of masks? I'm just curious.
Sting was in a gorilla mask. Andy was in a Brezhnev mask. Just big man. I actually wasn't. The BBC wouldn't let me mime with a mask because it looked stupid, you know.
And you were Clark Kent.
And so they painted up my face to obscure the identity. Didn't fool anybody. But fortunately, nobody knew who we were anyway. We weren't anybody. You know, everybody thought, who is Clark Kent for about 5 seconds in the zeitgeist of London? Who is Clark Kent? Is it Frank Zappa? Is it David Bowie? Is it, I don't know, Mahatma Gandhi? But the enemy busted me, fortunately. But the record company they did persevere with the Police because they had a hit with Clark Kent. But that was kind of behind the scenes.
Okay. And then afterwards, the second song that was released was Roxanne. And then Roxanne, did it immediately get some real play, or did that kind of bubble up a little bit?
Well, eventually it did hit. At first, the BBC didn't add it to their playlist. We didn't make the cut. Simple as that. However, my brother Miles, who's a great marketer, said, banned by the BBC because it's about a prostitute. And we made a lot of hay out. Banned by the BBC, the Police, who are too, you know, insurrectionist, too dangerous. Oh, that dangerous band, the Police. And we made a bit of hay out of that. But eventually, I think second or third time around, it did make the playlist and did become a hit. In fact, it became a hit while we were on tour in America. And we were struggling across the ocean of America, playing clubs, trying to break the big one.
Yeah.
And we went back to England at the end of this tour. Then we had heard that Roxanne had hit the charts, but it didn't really make much sense to us. Then we were booked on a tour supporting another band called Los Albertos Trios, which is a comedy band. A really great band, actually, but it was all comedy. As soon as we went out on stage for the first show, it was pretty clear whose tour it was. And it was just full of, you know, after all the dues we paid, after being a fake punk band,
yeah,
and discovering that we're actually kind of a good prog band in America, and all the journey and the struggle, we emerged suddenly in that shrieking high-pitched sound, which is the sound piranhas would make if they could make a sound, of the tweeny boppers. And unbelievably, we emerged from the darkness as a boy band.
God, crazy.
Go figure. And we were on the front of all these teeny bopper magazines, and Sting was all Mr. Beautiful. You know, go figure. We tried to be a punk band. We're actually too sophisticated for that, but ended up as a boy band.
God, that's incredible. Because that album is certainly feels punk to me. It was something that was completely different at the time.
You're as handsome as Stingo, the tweeny boppers are going to go for it.
Well, don't sell yourself short. Come on, Stuart.
Yeah, okay. There were three blonde heads.
Yeah, okay. There you go. By the way, one of the great album covers, Ghost in the Machine, with the, you know, the digital. I still think that's classic. Okay,
yeah, a lot of people still don't know what it means.
Really?
Yeah, it's the three. That's the three of us represented by LEDs.
Of course.
But at the time, people were mystified, Bart, and our management were convinced that that cost us several million in sales. Because it didn't have a picture of the three blonde heads.
Yeah, it was always pretty obvious to me. But maybe that's the way my brain works. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and then we're going to get into Police Deranged, the upcoming album from Stuart Copeland. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back with Stuart Copeland. And now, Stuart, let's talk about this new album of yours called Police Deranged for Orchestra, which is, I was listening to some of the tracks before this and Roxanne, because we were talking about Roxanne, and it is deranged in a really kind of remarkable reinvention, reimagination way. But how did this all come together and how did you think about taking this approach and releasing this album?
Well, the pieces actually do come from Police, just other bits of Police that you never heard before. And it came about as a result of a movie that I made from Super 8 footage that I shot of from the motels to the stadiums, of shooting everything that moves. And 20 years later, they invented computers, and I was able to digitize all that and make the home movie from hell, which just on an off chance I sent to Sundance, who wrote back and said, hey, look, we'll show the movie. We'll present your movie, which meant that I had to make it into a real movie, which means it needed a soundtrack. And I was at that time a professional film composer, and I knew how of the movie, but we didn't have film music, but it had to be Police music, but just alternative Police music. So I found imprints from stage, blind alleys in the studio, just like other Police alternative versions of stuff, and carved them together to create what I called at the time derangements, other versions. And then another unrelated story is that I was playing shows with orchestra as a result of my 20 years as a film composer. I had an involuntary education in how you use an orchestra and how to put it on the page so that they will play it. So those two things came together, my work with orchestra and these derangements, to bring the world Police Deranged for Orchestra.
Well, you're touring throughout the year, and you have some, I think you've already had a U.S. show or two. But
no, I played 25 shows here. Oh. I was in Chicago area last week.
Okay.
London a couple of weeks before that. I'm heading out I've been playing the show for like a year now. And eventually the penny dropped, hey, let's make a record of this. So we have.
So what has the reaction been to from the fans? Do they have any kind of expectation coming in of what this experience is going to be like? Or what do you think?
Well, they're not coming after me with pitchforks. In fact, the shows go over really well. It's a real barnstormer of a show because with the orchestra.
Yeah.
You know, and I go and I sit in with, you know, the Vancouver Symphony, the Chicago, the Cleveland, Atlanta, Nashville symphonies in those cities. And I just bring my charts, flop them out, count them in, and they play it. But I do bring three sisters, soul sisters on the mic, three beautiful women who are like the Supremes or the Chiffons. It's sort of like hearing the Police sung by the Ronettes. So that's what we do on stage. And people are curious. I do play hide the hit sometimes, but by the end of the show, the place is rocking. The show never fails. It's a real easy win, this show, because everybody knows the songs and it's a great musical environment. And it's a pretty slam dunk of a show.
So when you play and you tour with these different symphonies, what is the process of that?
Oh, it's real simple. I show up in Atlanta, 2:00 at their symphony hall. I meet the orchestra for the first time. How y'all doing? Okay, 1, 2, 3. And we play it down, and I have 2.5 hours rehearsal with
Come
the
on.
Orchestra. Yep, 2.5 hours rehearsal with the orchestra. Doors open at 7:00. Show at 8:00 that night.
How does that even happen for all these musicians?
It's on the page. I put it on the page. I don't just put what notes to play. I put how to play them. It's not just da 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 da. It's da 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 da. And I got to put that information on the page, the articulation, the dynamics, everything, the shape of how they play this stuff. And they read this stuff. Their ethos, their reason for drawing breath is to faithfully play the page. Now, yeah. Your rock musicians need 6 weeks of rehearsal, of arguing and compromise and throwing ideas back and forth to get their show together. But the orcs put it on the page and they will play it.
God, it's pretty amazing that it
does. And they play it incredibly well, too. They really lean into it. And I chat up the orchestra. I've got my pickup lines. You know, I go over to the woodwinds, and in a loud voice, I say to the oboist, "So, tell me about your reeds." It's an orchestra joke. You know, they tell drummer jokes in rock and roll, but they tell oboe jokes in orchestra and viola jokes. And I go and I bond with them all, make friends with them all. So then when we play the show, they're my crew. They're ready to rock. And I turn the mighty Nashville Symphony for just one night into a rock band.
That's great. And do you notice when you go from orchestra to orchestra, is there a different feelings or different sounds that are evoked across? So there's a different personality with them?
Amazingly, because they're playing exactly the same information, theoretically exactly the same way as per their instructions on the page. In fact, the Chicago Symphony does have a different feel from the Cleveland Orchestra. It's hard to put your finger on it. In some orchestras, the brass section is particularly bright. In some orchestras, the strings really shine. And even though they're all playing the same music, human beings, we all have two eyes and a nose and one mouth, but we're all really different. And the same is true of the orchestras. Even though they have the same components, they have exactly the same marching orders, each orchestra has its own personality.
Since you mentioned this about the humanity behind it and the personality behind it and how the notes on the page are exactly the same, but the sounds that come out are not, I have to ask you about artificial intelligence and how that's impacting the music industry and the different feelings. I don't know if you saw what Peter Gabriel was writing and then what Grimes is doing, where Peter Gabriel is very much it's another tool. So he's, you know, everybody needs to embrace it, that sort of thing. Grimes, of course, has embraced it. Other artists are understandably very concerned for a variety of reasons, including taking their voices, taking their music stems, and creating something without the participation of the artist themselves. So how do you feel about AI in your world?
I would agree with Peter Gabriel. It's a tool. Artists can use it. An analogy would be the drum box, which was originally designed for a lounge keyboard player to have some kind of accompaniment without having to hire a guy. And you'd have a little box with four settings, rock one, rock two, samba, and rumba or something. It would go uchta, 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 and the pianist could play along with this electronical accompaniment. Well, I got myself one so that I could have a drummer in my living room while I was doing my home recordings, and I could play guitar to the drum box. And they gradually got more and more sophisticated to the point where people were actually, I think the first person actually used one on a record that you could hear, I think was Peter, Phil Collins. It's the first time you could actually hear the drum box on the record. And from there, it kind of grew and was considered to be a great threat to drummers. But in fact, drummers like myself, we got hold of these things and started making use out of them ourselves. And they became another tool used by drummers. And it turns out that human beings love to dance to an electronically created rhythm. Go figure, this primal impulse to thrust our pudenda in public can be most stimulated by a machine. How does that work? But anyway, but it's true. Humans are, you know, the regularity of it does work. So AI is similarly a tool. It can be threatening, but it can be used as well. I will share with you a secret. Don't tell anybody.
I won't.
But I unfortunately did establish a tradition of, you know, every Valentine's, Mother's Day, and birthday, I write a little poem for my wife and love of my life. And it brings me great joy. Or rather, it did 30 years ago when I started this. And 30 years later, I've used up my rhyming dictionary. I love you because you're blue. Let's go to Tiffany's and get something new. You know,
that's not bad.
Yeah. So AI, except I've used that. And so AI comes along and I put in Mother's Day. Okay. Mother, she's the boss. Give a few, lines, and it comes back and it's pretty anodyne, pretty lame, but it's something to work with, and I can jigger it here and push it there and just sort of tart it up and change a few words, and I got something. And so AI gave me kind of a starting point. It's not good enough, but it gave me a starting point. I once tried to give me an opera plot. Okay, you know, a story, got this element, that element, this historical character. Give me a plot. And oh my God, it came up with really lame stuff, and I couldn't use any of it. So it's early days, though.
It is early days.
Let's, you know, in 2 years, or maybe probably in 10 minutes, it's going to be much better than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, no question.
Yeah, it's going to be threatening. You know, there are some things in life. You know, communism is a fantastic idea morally, inarguably superior morality, but it just doesn't work when humans get their hands on it. And I think the idea that all information should be available to everybody anywhere, that's got to be a good thing, right? No, it actually is causing strife and disharmony in our communities. It's an inarguably good thing, but can cause evil. And I think AI is going to do a lot of good things, but it's also, as people are saying, probably pretty dangerous too.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly understand from the artist perspective, obviously both perspectives, but the idea of taking police stems, you know, stems from your songs and your voices and your drum, you know, your drum beats and
that's already out there. Those samples are already out there.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. I remember John Bonham was the first where you could get John Bonham grooves, and that's from the record, damn it. Yeah. And they were available as samples. I think I might have even used them in a film score in a couple places. You know, it's a tool. Bruce Springsteen used my snare drum from Every Breath You Take in one of his big hits. I've been sampled all over the place. You know, Message in Every Breath You Take, Andy was sampled ferociously by Puff Daddy to create a whole new song. So AI is late to the game when it comes to ripping off the original artist.
Right. Ripping off has been there from the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. One thing going back to the Police Deranged for Orchestra, one of the things I read is that as you were piecing pieces together, you came to the quote-unquote unpleasant conclusion that Sting is a fucking genius and Andy's also a genius, but that's what I read, so.
Yeah, and all this is my revenge, you know. Most guitarists, they can get an amp that goes to 11.
Yeah.
But old Andy, his fingers go to 11. You know, I'm sure he's got 11 or 12 of those things, those chords he holds down. How's he do that? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Takes me a whole orchestra to reproduce Andy's stuff.
One of the things that you are coming up with, again, something I read, was a rock opera with Chrissie Hynde of Pretenders. And is that something that's going to be seeing the light of day this year?
It played in Italy. It opened in Italy last summer.
I didn't know.
And we're productions of that, even as we speak. But it's not really a rock opera. It's an opera with opera singers doing all their opera thing. But within it, one of the characters, it's about witches in the Alps and the witch hunts of olden times. But one of the characters is an anomaly. She's an anachronism. And she's, the head witch is like from the future. And I figured, let's get a rock sound for that one character. And since it's about women, I figured out how to talk to a woman. And so I called Chrissie, who is no ordinary woman, it turns out. And she got in there and she completely lobotomized the whole concept of the opera, which is a really good thing. And she wrote five songs, but mostly it's an opera with just this rock element in it. It's called The Witch's Seed.
Will that become a soundtrack?
I'm working on all that. That's all in the future.
Okay. And then you have your upcoming book, Stuart Copeland's Police Diaries. That comes out later this year. That's what you were talking about.
Yes. The actual pages from my diaries of those years with modern commentary about what it all meant. The day Sting and I first met, our first shows, how much we got paid, how much the truck cost, how well we did, and the general grind of our time together in those years before Andy joined. Well, including when Andy joined, we still starved. It took a minute, but then Sting started writing those big songs, and the Police then ate everything in its path.
So I have to ask you the same question I asked Nick Mason, that everybody wants to know. Is there any chance that you all will get back together to do a tour, a new album, or anything along those lines?
Very slim. I don't think so. We're all three of us enjoying playing these same songs. Andy's doing a tour in Brazil with a band. And actually, he's playing with a drummer who's a good friend of mine. And that's probably a great show. I'd go see that show. Andy and João Barone. That's going to be a cool show. And Sting's, of course, playing them too. So all three of us are out there. And we've talked amongst ourselves and remarked on the fact that how great it is to play these songs without those other two assholes. You know, my bass player doesn't turn around and give me shit.
So what would it take?
Oh, I don't know.
I have to put you on the spot a little bit.
You know, we're getting along so well. And okay. We like life the way it is.
Yeah.
And it would be fun. It would be fun because it is fun, inarguably, to play to a stadium and to rock the house with a stadium. That is a lot of fun. But a police tour is such a huge thing that we're like cogs in a wheel. We're like, even though we might be central to the mission, we're just soldiers in a huge army. And it eats your life. It's just too big. And we're kind of enjoying life as civilians.
Maybe one major event for climate change. I don't know. I'm going to think about some ideas. Okay.
All right. Come back. Get back to me.
All right. Well, at least you have the invitation to come back to you about that. So that's good. That gives people hope out there.
Yeah, I'd give it like an easy 1% chance.
Okay. Well, it's not zero. That's good.
Yeah.
Everything's lightning in a bottle. We've talked about all the different things that you've done, and not all of them. So many different things, so many different media that you work in. And what haven't you done that's on your bucket list?
I'm getting into ballet. I have done ballet, but mostly I've been doing opera. But I'm getting back into it, inspired by Instagram and TikTok. And these dances that people are doing are amazing. And I want to take that stuff into the fine arts world with an orchestra and in the fine ballet companies. And I'm really moved by that stuff. I don't know any of their names, these people, but like in Korea and in America and Romania, they're these strange clips of like Eastern Europeans with baggy suits and neckties and bow ties, even doing these bizarre comedic dances. I love all that stuff. And so I want to write some ballet. I regard an opera house as a building with an orchestra in the pit, all kinds of talent on the stage, and all kinds of infrastructure for me to tell a story with music. And so even though ballet is not an inspiring word, the talent that is available under that banner is very cool.
What are you most proud of? What would you, up to this point in your career?
I'm sorry, but it's a namby-pamby answer. It's my kids.
I love it.
I got 7 kids, 5 grandkids, and 4 grandpuppies. And that is the meaning of life. That is the reward. I got my Grammys, and I got my gold discs, and I got all kinds of other accolades, but they fade. But the kids, you know, I've in the warm embrace of my kids, I feel safe. I feel complete.
Yeah.
I feel that I mean something. I have a place in the universe. And they're 7 great kids, 4 sons, 3 daughters. And so if I dribble to the left, I got my son Patrick going to pick me back up. If I stumble to the right, there's Jordan to grab me. If I burst into tears, Celeste is going to cheer me up. I'm covered. I'm safe.
I love that. I'm a sentimental guy, so I love that. Good for you. Good for you.
That sucks.
So, Stuart, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really enjoyed it. Love the energy. You know, I was going to ask. You know, I think I'm a pretty energetic guy, but my God, how you find the time in each day to do all the things that you've done. Congratulations to you on all that. So thanks for joining on The Story Behind the Song. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for listening. Take care now.
That was Stuart Copeland, drummer extraordinaire of The Police, sharing his story behind The Police's most iconic song, Roxanne, which is now nearly 50 years old. Hard to believe. And that's a wrap on a very special season 4 of The Story Behind the Song. Another season of amazing interviews with music icons and legends that I'm privileged to host. We now have over 50 timeless episodes in our banks here at Consequence that you can enjoy anytime until you wait for season 5. Just look for them on the Story Behind the Song show in your podcast feed. And keep checking that feed. We may have a very special, entirely new bonus episode coming your way because, well, why not? We're here to please. There are so many great song stories to tell. I'm your host, Peter Chadi with Deep Cuts Media. You can find me at deepcutsmedia.com. If you like my show, please rate it, follow it, and share it with your friends, family, and other music fans just like you. And make sure to check out all the cool The Story Behind the Song merch, including the show's poster. And in the Consequence store, you'll also find the puzzle. So go to consequence.net to see all the great merch. And until next season, or until this very special new bonus episode that's coming your way, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.